Hi, everybody. We are recording today's episode of Adapting in October 2022, and we are specifically recording in the lead up to the Memorial Day commemorating the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in November of 1995. The reason for today's discussion is to bring to all of you not just a curriculum and a specific pedagogy around argument, but really to go in depth into talking about why argument, or perhaps how argument, can be used by teachers when talking about controversial issues, in this case about Israel and related matters. It gets a bit more complicated when we're talking about something which in society is regarded as being so divisive, but then we talk about arguments as a real constructive force in pedagogy and in classrooms and in all educational settings. And today's discussion with Abby and Robbie really goes into the nuance behind why argument shouldn't be seen as a negative, but really has valuable assets to add and things that young people should be truly embracing as they talk about the complexity of today's world. So we go on a bit of a journey today talking about all things related to pedagogy and Israel, elections, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. I think there's something in this for all educators, and I think you'll enjoy today's conversation as much as I did.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education. Today's conversation is really going to be an interesting one where we talk about the role of argument and healthy dialogue when it comes to Israel and Israel education. I am here with my colleagues and friends, Abby Dalverstern and Robbie Greengrass, and they both think that argument and dialogue are key to this educational experience as well. And they're here today to talk to us about what that means for Jewish education. So I really want to start by welcoming both of you to today's episode.
Hi, thanks, David.
Hi there.
It's great to have you both with us. And I want to start by getting right into the crux of this whole discussion about argument. And for those people that just want a quick behind the scenes look of what takes place on Adapting, the three of us can actually see each other in this medium, and we're recording this as an audio podcast. And why I raise this is because so much of the last 2+ years has been conducted over Zoom or some other form of social networking and communications. About midway through the pandemic, the article that I didn't write, and I can't work out why I didn't write it, was going to be, I can only hope for the day when we can argue again. And the reason for that is I felt like the medium of Zoom and digital communication was really, really didactic in terms of I would say something, someone would respond, someone else would say something, and there was never really a discourse or an argument taking place. And for me, this became really apparent at a board meeting, and board meetings are very well scripted over Zoom. Like, you've got 4 minutes for this topic and 6 minutes for this topic. And all of a sudden, somebody said something which took the board meeting on a tangent, and all of a sudden it was seen as, oh my goodness, that is so controversial. I can't believe that person said something. We all went into lockdown, we have to try and work out how do we retrieve the whole board meeting. And then along comes this book, and it actually sort of like validates this whole or this notion that argument is actually essential to human discourse and to human behavior. And I want to hear a bit from you about why you have decided to really hold up this notion of argument, which in most circles I would deem as being a negative value, especially in education. Like, who wants an argument in the classroom? But both of you have really decided to highlight argument as being central. And I think especially coming out of this, you know, only digital age, I think there's something more to this as well. So Abby, why have you decided to highlight argument as such an essential part of pedagogy?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is all of the research about argument that I have seen, and a lot of it is in a book by Ian Leslie, shows that argument is critical to all aspects of life. The right kind of argument, certainly. But disagreements between people are better for business. They're often better for even for marriage, depending on the kind of arguments. They're better for learning. They're just better. They're important because what they do is they invite other opinions. They invite us to think, wait a second, maybe I got that wrong and I better recheck my assumptions. And that's actually what education is fundamentally about. Let's try and understand the world better. And so that to me is the main reason why we think argument's important. There are other reasons as well, which is people have become really afraid, and for good reason perhaps, but really afraid to state their opinion. They're afraid they're going to say something that's inappropriate or offensive. They're afraid that they're inadvertently going to say something that they didn't think was racist, but turns out really was racist. And so they get shut down and then they say nothing. And the worst thing we have as educators is a group of silent people. We never want to be that educator who has nobody talking. We need to get them talking. And then I'll just say the third thing, and I'll hand it over to Robbie. The third reason we like arguments is they're emotional and cognitive. right? You need to use your brain, you need to be thinking, but you also need to use your emotions. And we want people to be passionate. We want our students to be excited.
I'd also like to point out, I think that totally with everything that Abby's just said, because of course we never argue amongst ourselves. I also want to say, David, I'm not sure that this unwillingness to have an argument began when we moved to Zoom. Our experience is that we were hitting these silent rooms before then, and that there were these concerns. And it's interesting that we talk about relationships and that there was something that we can get back to argue. There's an interesting sort of theoretical question. Do I need to thoroughly trust you before I can have a disagreement with you so I can be secure in my argument? Or might it be that only once we've had an argument can we really trust each other? As in, is the argument an indicator of friendship rather than a threat to it? And what we often do in our workshops is we often say, assume that you're going to end up being friends with whoever you have a disagreement with in the Israeli sense. What do I mean in the Israeli sense? I mean, it's an anecdote. Of course, it's representative of nothing, but of course, it's universally true. I remember once having an argument with someone in Israel. A screaming match. I didn't really want to get into the argument, but somehow I wasn't allowed to escape it. And I remember thinking that in England, where I emerged from, if you have a screaming fight with someone, that's the end of your friendship. You'll never speak to them again. Or at least if it's your mum, then it will be at least a week. Whereas in Israel, what I found was that this person needed an argument with me in order to feel like we were reaching a deeper level of friendship. And that sometimes clarifying our differences and where I'm different from you is a way for me to connect to you much better. And I think we've lost that. And I think that we're saying that Zoom and COVID, I think we're using it as an excuse, which actually also refers to the use of the word argument. I know that many people suggested to us that we don't use the word argument. They said, you know, it's a great idea, all this disagreement stuff, but don't use the word argument. That as Abby once said, people are so afraid of arguments that they can't even use the word now.
But Robbie, and here I need to really refer back to one of your earlier pieces that I think one of your major contributions, if not legacies, to the field of Israel education, which a lot of this is being applied to, is you coin the term hugging and wrestling. It seems like in this whole discourse about argument that you've forgotten a bit about the hugging, or have you?
Yeah, life moves on. No, that's... I think that, look, with the catchphrase hugging and wrestling, the key way in which it was misunderstood was that the most important word was the word and. The key challenge was to be able to do both at the same time. And that never happened. And I think that the challenge here also is argument. We assume that that's only wrestling and not hugging. When we're suggesting that if people come together and have deep disagreements from their hearts and from their guts and from their brains, they will end up closer rather than further away as human beings, even if their opinions may remain as far away as possible. We can hug people we disagree with. I know it's weird, but it's a possibility.
All right, so we've established that you both think that argument is important, but I actually now want to dial it back a little bit and say, when you say argument, what do you really mean? What do we mean by this form of conversation? Surely we don't expect the argument or conflict that's happening in the street or in the Knesset to be the one which we want to be taking place in the classroom either. So when you talk about argument from a pedagogical sense, what exactly are we referring to and what do you really expect to be taking place in the classroom setting?
First of all, I think, like you say, it's useful for us to clarify what kind of arguments we're talking about. And generally speaking, we can sort of see roughly three kinds of argument that go on in general, not only about Israel. One kind of argument is the debate, where my intention is to convince you that I'm right and you're wrong. And that has its value, but we're not doing that. There's also the kind of argument which is more like a difficult conversation in order to negotiate a shared decision. That's also important, but not what we're talking about. I think that there's a third kind of argument, or we think there's a third kind of argument, which we'll call it a healthy argument, or an argument for the purposes of growth and education, which means that by the end of having our argument, I may convince you, but I may not convince you. And we may reach a consensus or we may not reach a consensus, but we'll certainly have learned a great deal more about this issue.
I'll just add to say, a healthy argument is one that's experienced as an adventure and not a threat.
So, Abby, a few of us are familiar with the concept of a machloket l'shem shamayim, or an argument for the sake of the heavens, so to speak. And I know that you're familiar with that concept as well. So maybe explain to the listeners what's meant by that concept and how this type of argument is similar or different to the concept of machloket l'shem shamayim, which some of our listeners will be more familiar with, I would say.
Sure. In Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, there's a Mishnah that talks about argument for the sake of heaven, for the Lashem Shemaim, and that's sofa lehitkayem. That kind of argument is one that endures. The question, of course, is all sorts of commentary on what is endures. And that, I'd say a lot of people talk about that, and it is a very important text. We actually like to quote a really interesting Rebbe Nachman of Bratslav, a Hasidic master, who talks about machloket, argument, being an aspect of creation, that the creative act is, in fact, one of separating oneself, differentiating oneself, and making space. And that act of making space is really what argument, or healthy argument, is about, is what creation is about. We consider that a healthy argument. We consider that machloket l'shem shamayim. Rabbi Nachman compares this act of argument to the godly tzimtzum, to the sort of withdrawing or making space that God makes in order to create the world. And Rabbi Nachman compares that to what the scholars do in having argument with one another. They make space for argument itself.
So when I first heard about this project, I must admit that I found the name of the whole topic a bit startling as well. For the sake of argument seemed to be a bit jarring for myself as well, even though I do ascribe to some of the things that you're talking about in terms of challenge and transformation and growth all being inherent in education. I agree with all that. And then I began reading the book. And I think we need to explain, like, what's the book of the book, so to speak? Just for the audience, I just did air quotation marks, which is useless on a podcast. But to explain, like, the stories in the book really do begin to explicate what's meant by argument. So let's talk about the curriculum that you've designed to go with this. And I think then we get a bit more of a flavor of what it is that we're talking about. So Robbie, talk a bit about the origins of the book that you co-authored called For the Sake of Argument.
Yeah, Stories for the Sake of Argument is a book which contains 24 very short stories, specifically written to be read out loud. So it's specifically designed for either a classroom or a group or a Friday night dinner table with your kids. So it's deliberately written to be read out loud in order to bring about a disagreement or an argument. And so in one sense, it's fictionalized. And in that sense, it's one step removed from my own personal experience, which might allow me not to get too upset about stuff because it's not necessarily me on the one hand. You know, it's in this no penalty area of illusion. But at the same time, the stories all refer to big questions in the world, in the Jewish world and in Israel in particular. So the book's kind of divided into sort of three kinds of stories. Some of them are kind of warm-up stories, which are, they may present a disagreement, but it's not a particularly hot topic that we must fight over. There are the allegories, and there are the stories which are very specifically Israel-based. If you'd like, I can just read you one of the very short allegory stories. So this is a story called King of the Travellers, which I actually first heard told by a brilliant folk hero from England called Rory MacLeod. Here's where the story goes. This is based in England. The King of the Travellers was a strong man, with strong arms and a stronger tongue. He would never give way without a fight, and if not a fight, then an argument. One night, he and his people arrived at some nice flat land and began to set up camp for a while. Suddenly, a car drew up and a flustered man stepped out. "Oi, you lot, you can't stay here. This is private property," he shouted. The King of the Travellers ignored him and waved everyone to carry on unpacking. "I said this is private land. You've no right to be here." The King's ears pricked up. He turned away from his caravan and calmly said, "I have many rights indeed. And seeing as this here is private land, I promise to be right and private while I'm here." "It's my land. It's my land, and I want you all to leave." "Your land, is it? And how do you know it's your land?" The man looked back quizzically, never having been asked this before. "I know it's my land because my father gave it to me." "And how did your father know it was his?" "Because his father gave it to him, and his father before him." "And how did your great-grandfather come to own this land?" "Because his father gave it to him and his father before him." "And how did your great-great-great-grandfather come to own the land?" "Well, it was hundreds of years ago," hesitated the landowner. "Even many hundreds of years ago. How did he come to own the land? He fought someone for it. Did he indeed? Said the King of Travellers, smiling, beginning to roll up his sleeves. So now I'll fight you for it. So that's a story which is obviously is an allegory. It's a story which one can apply to thinking about conquest and ownership and belonging of land in the land of Israel. And it's also something we could talk about New Mexico.
So, Abby, when you hear that story, what's going through your mind as both an educator and a learner when you hear that story? And I'm interested in your response earlier that it's both cognitive and affective responses that you're looking for.
Great. So a few things are going through my mind. One is just, first is just listening to the story. Is getting involved in what's going on, whose land is what is there really going to be a fight? We're getting involved in who are these people? And then second, if I were to unpack it, whether it was, you know, as a student or as an educator, to start to draw out what the allegory is. What analogy are we making? Or who are the two people involved in arguing over this land and fighting over the land? Thinking about the different cases, the one that's closest to me, perhaps I live in New Mexico, as Robbie said, and we're on the border of Mexico, right? And I'm wondering about, wait a second, is this my land? Is this someone else's land? Maybe I live in Native American land, and I don't know how I'm going to refer to the place that I live. And I'm going back, right, to thinking about the story. Or maybe I live in Israel, or maybe I'm thinking about Israel. And so first of all, using many different reference points for this story. And our stories, we have, as Robbie explained, we have many different stories, but our allegorical stories are intended not to just be focused on Israel, but to have a much broader lens on the experience. And I think that's in large part what a story like this is meant to do, is to say, okay, even when we're learning about Israel, it's not just about Israel, it's about larger questions in life. There are many different stories. This one story in the book is a story about land. It's a story about something very contentious, both in Israel and in the United States and many other countries as well. And there are many other kinds of stories as well that aren't about land, that are about other contentious issues, whether it's about religion and state, whether it's about personal rights that we have. There are specific instances in the world that we need to pay attention to. Yes, of course, there are big policy decisions. Of course, there's the big statements that we make or the political affinities that we have. But in most cases, there are also human beings involved. And a lot of the arguments don't actually focus on that. And actually, the educational moment, I think, or the most important educational moment is seeing who the individuals are. And these stories take larger issues and try and drill down into, well, what happens to the little girls, right? To the little people at the bottom. How do we get there? And how do we look at them and understand them and not only look at political platitudes, if I can call them that.
Can I add one additional thing there, David? If we talk educational language, I think what we're effectively saying is that every healthy argument, at the heart of every healthy argument, is what we in education call an essential question. An essential question is one which you go back and forth, and there isn't one very clear answer that you can get from Google. And effectively, an essential question is pointing out the complexities in the world. And I think where you get to rubbish arguments is when they're not actually about an essential question.
I really like the concept here of essential questions. I also like the notion here of challenging people with viewpoints that are not necessarily the ones that they would always associate themselves with. But here I want to ask Abby a question, and this deals with something which you wrote about recently in terms of, it wasn't quite in the context of argument, but you wrote recently about cancel culture, or when we don't include all voices in certain discussions. And I'm really interested here, and we'll link to that article specifically in the show notes, which was part of the Sapir Journal on Education. But I'm really interested here, like, what are the limits of argument, especially the ones that we want to expose our young people to? And are there viewpoints which you actually believe are off limits or shouldn't be brought into a classroom because by the virtue of you actually bringing them into the discourse, you're de facto endorsing them? Or do you believe as an educator that all viewpoints should be out there for young people or for any learner to actually digest and then make a decision for themselves? And I think this is a particularly, it's a sensitive issue, and we could name any number of specific topics where this is a relevant issue. But in terms of Jewish education, many come to mind. But I'm wondering, like, what are the limits of the argument which you as an educator deem to be acceptable? And are there red lines that you say, no, I can't actually go there?
So I'll be honest to say that in general, I don't like red lines. I find them, generally, this isn't always true, but I generally don't find them helpful. I do find guidelines and rules of thumb a lot more useful. And so I would say that we're trying to stretch people's definition of what's okay to say and how to say it. I think what's really important is we don't want to encourage offending others. We want to discourage offending others, right? And so we certainly, I certainly do not want racism, right, in places where I'm at. That feels like crossing a certain kind of line. But when that happens, I think the question is, let's say that does happen, somebody says something racist. I think the question is, how do we respond? And that's why I'm against these sort of red lines. Because I think as educators, this might not be true in political places, it might be in other places, but as educators, when somebody says something that does seem to cross a moral line, the question is, how do we respond? What do we do? What we're trying to play with is to stretch that a little bit. Just, you know, let's say somebody does say something racist. What's the appropriate response? Is it to kick the person out of the room? Is it to shut the person down? Is it to say, whoa, hold on a second, you've really offended a whole bunch of people in the room. You've offended me personally. I need to understand where that statement came from. And for me, that's the appropriate response. And what to do if the person is actually a racist? Okay, that's a whole other conversation. But sometimes people say things and they don't realize how it comes out, and they need to be corrected. And the only way that we can learn is by actually allowing for a greater diversity. It doesn't mean that those opinions are acceptable, but they are, I think, really important for us to figure out how to better manage them in the context of these kinds of conversations, especially when we're talking about younger populations who are really just learning this. Another, I just say, like, the flip side of that is what's happened in many settings, and I don't want to, they're not equivocal. I want to say again, they're not equivocal, but what does often happen is people are so afraid of saying something racist or homophobic or, right, all the things that we certainly do not want, but they're so afraid of saying anything, that of saying one of those things or saying the wrong thing, that they just shut down completely. And so then they don't engage at all. And I think that for me is a really big fear also. If we have classrooms and youth movements and camps and college campuses where people are just not engaging at all. And that is also really not helpful to the work we're trying to do. And so we are trying to figure out what the right line is and how do we invite people in and correct them, rather than to say, you know, go away and don't be here.
It's interesting. I can think of two recent examples in the Jewish Education Project's history where these issues have become very apparent. These are two examples not related to Israel, where it's always apparent, by the way. One was over the issue of gun control. And as a pluralist organization, like, what should we as an agency be coming out as an educational philosophy when it comes to issues of school shooting? And we know that many people who support our work are in favor of the amendment rights to bear arms. And we know that many people are against it. As an educator, are there so-called, and I put this really in quotation marks for everybody to hear, like, good people on both sides of the argument? And more recently, we actually had the same discussion around issues related to abortion and abortion rights in America, because we have lots of people with very strong views on one side of the argument. Yet we know there are a lot of Americans who believe differently when we're having a discussion in a classroom about these two issues. Is it our responsibility to bring both points of views to the audience? Or are we actually supposed to take a moral stance on some of these issues and say, no, this is what we as an institution actually believe. There are other people out there who are wrong, and, like, you know, poor old Shammai, like, we know you have an opinion, but you're going to be outvoted or you're wrong, or we just ignore it completely. And I think this whole discussion about argument, it sounds at some levels that it becomes a 30,000 foot discussion. But I think educators are actually going through this dilemma as educators almost every time they choose to embark in a discourse around any topic of any significance in the world. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that particular topic. Yeah, Robbie.
Yeah, totally. Look, I think there are a couple of things. In our workshops that we run for educators, we're actually running a series of courses for the Jewish Education Project. One of the things that we do is that we say, with these controversial issues, I think it's not necessarily a question of giving both sides. I think the educator's job is to find the essential question at the heart of the fight, right? And the moment we do that, then we're raising up this spat or this fight, we're bringing it into the educational arena. And then what we're doing is we want to give agency to the learners so that they can begin to work through and make their decisions about stuff. And so, like, a lot of the theory would suggest that when you're dealing with something which is maximally controversial, the teacher shouldn't be giving their opinion, in particular because you don't know whether that meets with the opinion of every parent and every learner, and then you're going to get in trouble. But the idea of students arguing about stuff, important stuff which is going on in the world, and the educator raising up that argument so that it's dealing with essential questions, with values clashes and not just I hate you, really fits with, what a lot of the research is talking about. Diana Hess talks in her book, The Political Classroom, that you're better off if at least 20% of your lesson time is spent the students speaking to other students. not the back and forth between student and teacher, but back and forth between students. If you've got 20% of that going on, then something is happening with the learner and remains impactful afterwards.
So without giving away my age too much, I feel comfortable enough to say here that the events of 1995 were perhaps the most traumatic and formative in my life as a Jewish educator and as someone committed to the State of Israel with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And I've spoken about it briefly before on a previous episode with Noam Weissman about how those events are really part of history now for so many of our young people, not part of the reality. But in the aftermath of the assassination of Rabin, I remember the deep felt anger and frustration that I felt both as a human being and as a committed Zionist and also as an educator, that it was actually argument and disagreement and real division that it ultimately led to the most catastrophic of all of endpoints. And it's really difficult for me, even with so many years having passed, now beginning to accept that argument and that sort of division can actually be seen as a healthy pedagogic tool. I use that as a background because I know that you're foreshadowing the use of this pedagogy and this curriculum in the build-up towards the commemoration of Rabin Memorial Day. And I want to speak a bit about the juxtaposition of all of these things together. So let's talk a bit about, I guess, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, more importantly for this conversation, the events leading up to it, how this connects to your work today and how you see it playing out in contemporary times for Jewish educators. Abby, I'd love to hear your response to that.
The assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the disagreements that I wouldn't say led to that, but that were a part of that, that surrounded that time, that were really resonant, is exactly what we are trying to prevent. We're trying to redeem argument. And there is the bad kind of argument and there's the good kind of argument. The bad kind of argument, there's more than one, but I'll generally say the bad kind of argument is one where only I can be right, that my ideas are so sacred and so holy that there's no room for anybody else's. And I will do anything, anything, and say anything and do anything to show that I'm right. We don't want that. That was the Rabin kinds of arguments. That was what happened behind the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. We're trying to say difference of opinion is a natural and a good thing in the world. We need people to disagree. We're diverse humans. We're different. And that includes differences of opinions. The question is, what do we do with those differences? How do we hold those differences? How do we communicate those differences? And that's what we want to practice and what we want to teach. And that is what we hope will prevent, not only prevent other atrocities, but also will create a better kind of citizen, a better kind of learner, and more educated humans.
So Robbie, do you want to explain a bit to our audience exactly what it is that you're planning and preparing around the Memorial Day for Yitzhak Rabin?
Sure. The idea actually came up several years ago when doing a tour of all sorts of different schools in Israel. I used to ask one question in every school, be it an ultra-Orthodox school or a secular, lefty, democratic school or whatever the school was, my only question would be, how do you mark Rabin Day? And every school had a different answer, which would give you an entire picture of the way in which they approach education and ideology and so on. And I'd suggest that across the diaspora as well, we know that we must in some way mark Rabin Day, and we don't quite know how. And I think that, as Abby just said, it's what happened before the assassination of Rabin, I would suggest, were not arguments in the sense that we're talking about it. They were screaming matches. Generally speaking, young Americans are very good at listening to each other, but not that great at giving their own opinion. And in Israel, it's the opposite. Everyone gives their opinion, but we're not that great at listening. Everyone was and continues to be convinced that a disagreement means I must convince you that you're wrong and I'm right. And if not, I'm going to shoot you. And I think that the idea of marking arguments about Israel on Yom Rabin, on Rabin Day, feels like that's exactly where it should be. Because as Abby said, when the argument ends, violence begins. In particular, when we're talking about an essential question over which there will never be agreement. We have to live with the disagreement and not necessarily solve it or end it.
It's really interesting that you mention that people are afraid of the word argument. And I remember vividly that I was at a conference once and we called the conference Failing Forward. And there was a visceral reaction to the word failure. Like, oh, people actually walked out of the conference because they said, I'm not coming to a Jewish education conference to talk about my failures or hear about people's failures. Like, mistakes they were okay with, but failures, that was emotional. And here I think the word argument also does have that visceral reaction, which hopefully will also show that, like, we're talking about something which is much more complex than my fact versus your fact, but it is actually this whole bringing of your full self into the educational experience. So thank you so much, both of you, for sharing with all of us today. It's been really, really helpful and informative, and we've explored lots of different topics, but I'm not going to let either of you go without answering a question which I have asked all of my guests so far on adapting, and that is the chance for you to pay tribute to an educator in your life who you think has been transformative or made an impact on you. So Robbie, let's go with you first. Who's someone you want to pay tribute to?
I'd like to pay tribute to somebody who I've learned most from actually while in the profession. There was a heyday of this unit called Makom, which was a unit inside the Jewish Agency, and it was run by my friend and mentor, Johnny Ariel. When he writes, he's Yonatan Ariel, but Johnny Ariel. And in particular, because we had a team of strong-minded, thoughtful people, and he forced us to argue with each other. He forced us to put our egos aside and allow ourselves to be critiqued and be pushed and to stand behind what we had to say and listen to other stuff. And I learned a hell of a lot from that whole approach and learned within the approach.
Abby, who's someone you want to pay tribute to?
So I second the Johnny Ariel, but I'll give another answer as well. As cheesy as it sounds, I actually really want to talk about my parents. For two reasons. One of the most memorable conversations was around Shabbat table at my parents' house when I was a child. And it was an argument with my brother. And it was a real argument, but a healthy one because I remember it. And it was an argument about, is somebody who is, we would now call it differently abled, right? Somebody who had cognitive disabilities, are they not as smart as somebody who doesn't? And I argued that they're just different, but they're as smart. It's differently smart, but smart. We had this big, big argument about it. And it stayed with me to this day. And that my parents had a table in which those kinds of arguments happened was totally incredible and is still true to this day. And I'll just add that my mother was our earliest reader, and she really encouraged us and added to our thinking, and I think helped the horizons of this book and of our project. And so I really want to thank my mother and my father.
I really want to thank both of you. For those who don't know, Abby, Robbie, myself have been friends and colleagues for a while, and I'm really, really happy and feel privileged to be on this journey with them and watching their work and their thinking evolve around this particularly important topic. I don't see it without challenge. I definitely see it as a source of continued conversation, if not argument, in the Jewish world as to how we adapt this type of pedagogy into our settings. The question of educators being prepared to deal with such complexity, being willing to lose a bit of control and letting the arguments take their own course, I know is going to be something which educators grapple with a lot. But really, I think this contribution is really enormous, both in the Israel education sense and more broadly for education and Jewish education as well. So thanks both of you for sharing this with all of us today.
Thank you.
To learn more about Robbie and Abby's work, you can visit their website on forthesakeofargument.org. Of course, we will link directly to its site in all of that show notes as well. As always, today's episode was produced by myself, Dina Nussenbaum, and Gabriel Weinstein. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. And our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. I do want to say, and I'm not exactly sure where this episode will land in the flow of things, that this might or could be close to Gabriel Weinstein's last episode as one of the producers on this show. Gabe has been one of the people behind the scenes at the Jewish Education Project who has been instrumental in bringing adapting to all of you, and we wish Gabe all the best on his next stage of his professional journey. It's been a true privilege and honor to be working with him over the last 4 years. If you enjoyed today's episode of Adapting or the season as a whole, please go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. Those things really do matter, and even better, share it with a friend. And as always, to learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit our website at jewishedproject.org. You can learn more about our mission, our history staff, and the wonderful programming that we bring to all of you. And as always, we are proud to be a partner of UJA Federation of New York. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks Robbie. Thanks Abby. Great to be with you all today.